Chapter 24 An Interpretation of the Myth of Mental Illness and My View of the Problem. Note this chapter covers some of the material that was already covered in Chapter 23, but it is covered from a different perspective as explained below. A description of this chapter. The first part of this paper is primarily based on the ideas and text of Thomas S. Shash's book The Myth of Mental Illness Revised Edition, 1974. That is, the paper is my interpretation of Shash's book, written in my own style. However, I added additional ideas and elaborations to my interpretation. I also excluded some of the less important ideas from the book. Note the term author in this paper refers to Thomas S. Shash. The first part of the paper is divided into 10 sections. The divisions are the underlined large type headings in quotation marks, which is Shash's original summary of his book. Each heading, which is in the author's original words, is interpreted and explained in my own style and wording. After the interpretation, I generally add my own elaborations and ideas. The amount of text under each heading ranges from several pages to one paragraph. The reason for this is simply because some of the headings required less text to explain. In Thomas S. Shash's book, which is nearly 300 pages, there are many statements and ideas that can be interpreted in slightly different ways. Thus, my interpretations are not the only possible versions. Part 2 of this paper is a summary of the problem, mental illness myth or reality from the perspective of the psychological, sociological, economic and technological components. An interpretation of the myth of mental illness and my view of the problem. Part 1 My interpretation and view. 1. Strictly speaking, disease or illness can affect only the body. Hence, there can be no mental illness. What the author means here is that the types of disorders that psychiatrists generally treat are not true diseases or illnesses. There are, of course, abnormal styles of thinking, communicating, and behaving. This includes abnormal reactions, unjustified anger, nervous reactions, irrational perceptions and interpretations of the world, and other unpleasant states of mind. Perhaps when such conditions are severe, they can be classified as psychological or psychiatric disorders. However, these unfortunate conditions that psychiatrists and psychologists generally deal with are not diseases, and are not caused by a biological abnormality. Such conditions are caused by psychological factors. The individual with such a psychological or psychiatric disorder is not ill. I believe that one can find exceptions to the ideas presented in this paragraph, but the exceptions are too few to invalidate the statement. It is necessary to define the words disease, illness and sickness at this point. The simplest dictionary definition that I can find is disease is a condition of a body that impairs its functioning. A more precise definition for this paper is the following. Disease is a biological malfunction, such as physiological or biochemical, that impairs the functioning of the body. The definition of illness or sickness is simply a person with a disease. Thus, the definition does not include the conditions that are traditionally called mental illnesses. The author's view is simply that mental illness is an invented concept, which is based on the false assumption that there is a biological cause for the condition. This is discussed on page 11 to 13 and elsewhere in Shash's book. That is, the idea is that conventional diseases were discovered and disorders such as hysteria and other mental illnesses were declared to be diseases. Sometimes, but certainly not always, a person that is declared to be mentally ill is simply a malingerer. The malingering is not necessarily carried out on a conscious level. The acceptance of the label mentally ill and/or a psychiatric diagnosis is certainly inadvertent rewards for the patient, which encourages him to play the role of a mental patient. The rewards can be freedom from the responsibilities that other people are faced with, such as earning a living, military service, etc. Other rewards for accepting the role of a mental patient can be disability benefits and insurance payments for psychiatric treatment. The author acknowledges that there are physiological disorders that affect behavior. There is no doubt about such diseases. They are neurological conditions that are definitely illnesses. There are also hormonal imbalances that cause the body to slow down, or speed up, or malfunction in some way, such as thyroid malfunction, diabetes, and many other conditions. These diseases impair the functioning of the body, as well as the emotional state and behavior of the patient. However, these diseases are not generally considered mental illnesses, and are usually not treated by psychiatrists. Such diseases are treated by neurologists, endocrinologists and other traditional medical doctors. When is the term mental illness used? The term is usually used when there are dysfunctional thoughts, feelings, or actions which are not associated with an obvious biological condition that directly impairs the body. This generally boils down to when an individual displays abnormal behavior that offends someone else and/or when the patient is bothered by her own thoughts or actions. This usually means that the individual's behavior deviates from the socially acceptable ways of thinking and behaving. I should add that the term mental illness or any psychiatric diagnosis is more likely to be applied to those with less power. This includes individuals that have little status in the society, such as the poor and uneducated. If there is a clear-cut biological cause for deviant behavior, the condition is generally not called a mental illness. An example is a person with severe diabetes, who might behave very strangely, but he will not be classified as mentally ill. Such an individual will not be treated by a psychiatrist or put into a mental hospital. Likewise, an individual that is suffering from an overactive thyroid gland will appear to be extremely nervous and display other unusual behavioral components. However, once the cause of her problem is known, the condition would not be considered a mental illness. Such conditions are treated by endocrinologists and other conventional medical doctors. Thus, the above conditions impair body, mind and behavior but are not generally called mental illnesses. However, if a person displayed the abnormal behavior manifestations of an individual with an overactive thyroid, without having such a disease, that is extreme nervousness and hyperactivity, he might be treated by a psychiatrist and possibly put in a mental hospital. There has been speculation since the time of Freud that the so-called mental illnesses are physiological diseases that affect the nervous system. However, unlike the neurologist or endocrinologist, the psychiatrist generally has no medical method of determining a so-called mental illness. That is, there is no conventional laboratory blood test or X-ray evaluation that the psychiatrist can use to determine that a mental illness exists in an individual. The reason for this, as already stated, is because the psychiatrist deals with abnormal behaviors and states of mind, not diseases. Most likely, if a clearly defined biological cause was found for a specific mental disorder, the condition would probably no longer be considered a mental illness. Psychiatrists would probably stop treating such a condition, and it would probably be treated by an endocrinologist or other medical specialist. Psychiatrists evaluate the behavior and thinking processes of the patient, and if an abnormality is found, the doctor might presume there is an unknown theoretical biological cause for the abnormal condition. In reality, they are generally treating a disorder that has a psychological cause, which may be unknown. Many doctors would acknowledge that the biological cause is really theoretical. Perhaps theological is a more accurate term as opposed to real. Some psychiatrists would most likely not really be sure of the causative components one way or the other. There are psychiatrists that would insist that there are biological causes for most, if not all, mental illnesses. They might insist that the biological malfunction cannot be easily detected with currently available techniques. Many psychiatrists would say that there is a biological basis for mental illness, or physiological factors are involved with the illness at some level. This is different than saying there is a biological cause for the behavioral abnormality. The problem with the last argument, which is more or less the official view, is all behavior has a biological basis at some level. When we talk, get angry, laugh, learn new material, or respond to anything in our environment, there are biochemical changes in our nervous systems and bodies. The author used as an example on page 101 the learning of the French language. If a person learns French or anything else, there is no doubt that there are some physiological changes that take place in the brain at a molecular level. Perhaps more dramatic examples are, if a close relative dies, we lose our job, or get attacked by a dog, there will be significant physiological responses throughout our body when we first confront the experience. The following section of my elaboration might deviate somewhat from the author's view. Prolonged stresses can produce long-lasting biochemical changes. The changes in biochemistry are certainly apparent when an individual is exposed to certain types of emotional stress, which could be triggered by her own thoughts and/or behavior. But the point is the emotional stress, and the reactions to the stress are not diseases. The primary cause of the resulting condition is psychological. Extremely abnormal responses might be seen if the individual also is not able to get adequate sleep because of the stress. In sleep deprivation experiments, the subjects often experience hallucinations as well as other abnormal behavioral manifestations. But none of the above have a biological cause. The condition is caused by environmental and/or behavioral factors. Specifically in this case, the cause is the experimenter who is keeping the subject awake. Some psychiatrists might insist that some people are more susceptible to such stresses, which probably is quite true. Note the author used hysteria as an example. In my elaboration, I am using clinical depression as an example because it is a more common disorder in contemporary times. Some psychiatrists might argue that if they supply medication that makes the person feel better, that is proof of a biological cause. That is, their argument is based on the fact that the medicine modifies the biochemistry of the body and produces an improvement in the patient's condition. However, this argument fails for two reasons. The first is there are many drugs that can make a person feel better without alleviating the true problem. The second reason is a bit more complicated and is explained in the following paragraph. As already stated, environmental factors as well as a person's thinking and behavior can cause biological changes, which are not diseases. For example, if a person was subjected to extremely depressing and anxiety-provoking experiences over a period of weeks or months, there would most likely be a reduction of certain chemical substances, such as neurotransmitters. The severity of the effect will vary from one individual to another. The condition most likely would be called clinical depression, and treated with antidepressant drugs, which will increase the neurotransmitter levels. The patient's mood might improve, however the environmental difficulties that caused the problem might be ignored by both patient and doctor. The patient may not inform the psychiatrist about the stressful circumstances that caused the condition. If the patient truly believes he truly has a disease, he may not even associate the stressful circumstances as a cause of the depression. The depression and the reduction in neurotransmitter chemicals are a natural result of certain types of prolonged stress. Under natural environmental conditions, such biochemical changes might have a survival advantage. The depressed state involves a reduction in motivation and a tendency to be less active. That is, the depressed state can be described as a tendency to hibernate until environmental conditions improve. A living creature that confronted a frustrating environment, such as facing insurmountable obstacles, enemies, intolerable environmental temperatures, food shortages, will have a better chance of surviving if the creature gets depressed, and perhaps actually goes into a true state of hibernation. Such states, of course, have a biological basis, but they are not diseases, and are caused by environmental factors. Thus, the depressed state in animals and humans are triggered by environmental factors and under certain circumstances might have a survival advantage. Perhaps a good counter-argument to the above is that conditions such as depression are generally highly dysfunctional states in a civilized human society, and should be treated as if the condition is a disease, which would involve medication. The difficulty with this argument is that all mental disorders do not involve significant biochemical changes in the body. And even many diagnosed conditions of depression might really be extreme discontent with life circumstances without any reduction in neurotransmitter-related chemicals. Some psychiatrists might say that if there is no reduction in specific neurotransmitters, a diagnosis of depression is not correct, but such assessments are probably quite common. Since there is no commercially available test to easily measure these chemicals, the entire concept is really theoretical at best. In addition, most abnormal behavior does not have any more or less of biochemical components than normal behavior. Severe clinical depression, extreme anxiety states, and perhaps a few other conditions are exceptions, but as already stated, even these disorders do not fit the definition of disease or illness. However, under certain conditions it might be justified in treating a psychiatric disorder as if it was a true disease, which involves medication. If the circumstances meet the following six criteria, I believe there is such justification. 1. If the patient and all concerned are informed that the condition is not really a disease, that is, the patient and his family are informed that the disorder that the patient is suffering from is not a biological illness. This is to imply that the patient and all involved must take responsibility for the psychological factors that are causing the disorder. 2. If the patient is informed that the disorder is most likely caused by their own behavior, thinking patterns and/or exposure to adverse environmental conditions, that is, the patient should be aware that their own thoughts, actions, living conditions and status in society might be causing their problems. 3. If non-medical methods were tried and failed, that is, if the patient tried a number of adjustment techniques including formal psychotherapy over a period of a year or longer with no significant improvement, then the use of medical methods may be justified. 4. If the medical treatment is reversible and poses little or no risk to the patient, this eliminates lobotomy, electric or insulin shock therapy. 5. If the patient truly wants to try a medical method of treating the problem, this generally eliminates treating a psychiatric disorder with medical methods when the patient opposes the treatment. 6. If the medical method is offered for the benefit of the patient and is likely to result in significant improvement in the condition, this generally rules out the use of medication to control patients for the convenience of caretakers. Of course, in the most extreme cases, such medical methods might be justified. Note, most of the above can be summed up with a computer model of behavior and malfunction. That is, an analogy can be made between a malfunctioning computer and mental and biological disorders in human beings. There are two basic types of computer malfunctions, hardware and software. A hardware malfunction is a difficulty with the electronics of the computer, which is analogous to a physiological disease in human beings. A software malfunction is a computer program that is not operating properly. There can be errors in the computer code or conflicts with other programs in the computer and many other difficulties. We can apply the concept of software to human beings and express the author's point. If we do this, the disorders that psychiatrists and psychologists generally treat are software malfunctions. However, there are drug companies and psychiatrists that would insist that it is a hardware malfunction, which is interfering with the proper operation of the software. The hardware malfunction is, of course, a biological disease. To mental illness is a metaphor. Minds can be sick only in the sense that jokes are sick or economies are sick. The author's point is that when we are talking about mental illness, we are talking about behavior, not a physiological disorder. The behavior might be dysfunctional and highly offensive to others, just as a sick joke is highly offensive to most people who hear it. Another way of explaining this is that sickness or illness means a body with a dysfunction. A sick economy means an economy with one or more dysfunctions. Thus, mental illness means a mind with one or more significant dysfunctions. One can argue that sickness or illness, in the general sense, means an entity with one or more dysfunctions. Although the above paragraph is very logical, when such a definition is applied to the mind, it is deceiving. The patient and her family might be inadvertently fooled into believing that a biological disease is causing the patient to behave in abnormal ways. If the patient's condition improves, her behavior becomes more in tune with society's standard of normal behavior, the patient will not necessarily be considered totally cured. The misconception of a biological cause will persist. The assumption of all concerned might be that if an unknown biological disorder, a disease, caused this patient to lose her mind once, it can happen again. The assumption would be that the condition is in remission. The above assumption could act as a self-fulfilling prophecy, because it will result in stigmatizing the individual, which can interfere with employment, the formation of new friendships, mate selection with the unmarried, and many other difficulties. The stigmatizing effect of psychiatric diagnosis is one of the author's main points, which is discussed in more detail below. 3. Psychiatric diagnoses are stigmatizing labels, phrased to resemble medical diagnosis and applied to persons whose behavior annoys or offends others. The author's point is that placing labels such as hysteric, schizophrenic, paranoid, on an individual is deceiving. Such labels give a false impression that the individual is suffering from a mysterious physiological disease that is affecting the mind and cannot be cured. In reality, the patient's behavior and/or thinking patterns are generally the problem. Both the patient and his family might believe that the individual is truly suffering from an incurable disease. The chances of being accepted by society are significantly reduced when such labels are attached to a human being. The patient might even be partially rejected by his family and friends. His overall life chances will probably be significantly reduced in all areas. The destructive effects of psychiatric labels are most severe when placed on children and teenagers. The author did not discuss the difference in impact of labeling the young and the more established older person. The reason for the more severe consequences for the young is the young must compete in our society to obtain the basic things they need to mature into healthy adults, such as friends, acceptance in school, college, mates and eventually employment. A psychiatric label would severely handicap the young person in the above competition. There are very few individuals who would want to marry or even become a close friend with an individual with a psychiatric label. An exception is perhaps other individuals with similar stigmatizing labels. The psychiatric label cannot necessarily be hidden from others because a young person who has been labeled since childhood is likely to develop a self-concept based on that label. The label or what it stands for will be either intentionally or inadvertently conveyed to others. Such individuals might simply decide not to make any significant attempts at obtaining normal friendships, mates, acceptance in school, etc. Another problem with the labels is they are very unscientific and in actual practice may not relate significantly to the actual cause of the disorder that the patient is suffering from. The unscientific nature of psychiatric diagnosis was demonstrated in experiments. These experiments are described in Readings in Social Psychology, Perspective and Method, edited by Brian Byers, 1993, Chapter 4. The original author is D.L. Rosenhan, titled On Being Sane in Insane Places. The experiment consisted of placing 8 normal volunteers in mental hospitals without informing the staff that these individuals were normal. The volunteers were instructed to behave in a normal manner. All the volunteers were diagnosed as schizophrenic and eventually were released from the hospitals with the diagnosis of schizophrenia in remission. The period of hospitalization ranged from 7 to 52 days. The average hospital stay was 19 days, which should have been an adequate period of time to see that these patients were normal. Incidentally, they tested 12 different hospitals throughout the United States, which shows that such misdiagnosis is a typical problem. Other problems with the labels are they are very deceiving and have certain questionable utility. They imply a disease is causing the abnormal condition, which makes the patient eligible for insurance and disability benefits. The author's view is that the insurance and disability aspects are abused by both the doctors and patients. A good counter-argument to this is those psychological and psychiatric disorders may not be true diseases, but such conditions can be very disabling and the patients with such conditions need professional help. Thus, assistance from insurance and disability benefits may certainly be justified in many cases. The label can put the patient in a position where she must think of herself as sick or at the very least psychologically disabled. She might not be able to obtain employment because of the stigmatizing effect of the label, as well as the disabling effect of the psychological disorder. Thus, the label can be more disabling than the psychological disorder. The label serves to tell the patient how to think of himself and how to explain himself to others. The psychiatric diagnosis tells the world how to treat the individual who has been labeled with the diagnosis. 4. Those who suffered from and complain of their own behavior are usually classified as neurotic. Those whose behavior makes others suffer, and about whom others complain, are usually classified as psychotic. The point of the author is that neurotic individuals are generally suffering from emotional conflict or some other internal discomfort. Their behavior, even if somewhat unusual, generally does not bother other people to an extreme degree. The neurotic might be bothered by her own thoughts and actions. On the other hand, individuals that are classified as psychotic might not mind or even be aware of their abnormalities. Their behavior can be quite objectionable to their family and society in general. Patients with psychotic disorders might not be aware of their circumstances, thus they might not be bothered by their condition. The above view of the author is probably sometimes true. His statement probably accurately describes many of his patients. However, in the actual situation there can be neurotic individuals that make their family and friends miserable. And there are individuals that are suffering from psychotic disorders that causes them great personal suffering and bothers nobody else. 5. Mental illness is not something a person has, but is something he does or is. What the author means by this statement is mental illness is not a physiological condition causing a person to behave abnormally. The abnormal behavior is something the person does. The author mentions abnormal styles of communication such as found in hysteria, schizophrenia, and many other conditions. Shash also mentions game playing, which can be dysfunctional or semi-functional manipulative techniques to deal with the world. Thus, the mental illness is something an individual is doing. The doing can be his behavior or thinking. The individual declared mentally ill is a mental patient. Such a person is mentally abnormal. The word is apparently the result of the designation placed on the individual by psychiatrists and society in general. His neighbors might say he is crazy. The patient's psychiatrist might say he is mentally ill. 6. If there is no mental illness, there can be no hospitalization, treatment, or cure for it. Of course, people may change their behavior or personality, with or without psychiatric intervention. Such intervention is nowadays called treatment, and the change, if it proceeds in a direction approved by society, recovery or cure. The author's inferred point is that the psychiatrist is dealing with abnormal behavior, not an illness. The behavior is obviously offensive or objectionable to people in the environment or society in general. The patient's life circumstances or her own emotional conflicts can be quite unpleasant, but this is not an illness. Since such conditions are not diseases, the condition cannot legitimately be treated by medical means. Hospitals are medical facilities and thus cannot provide the needed services. That is, there can be a cure for a disease, but there cannot be a cure for offensive abnormal behavior. Thus, the psychiatric hospital can provide very little, if any, true assistance for their patients. The author acknowledges that people with psychiatric disorders can change their behavior or personality, with or without psychiatric intervention. That is, the individual with a psychiatric problem can improve with the help of a psychiatrist or by other means. The author points out in a statement that psychiatric intervention is called treatment. The quotation marks and the structure of the author's statement suggest the term treatment is inappropriate, because a psychiatric disorder is essentially abnormal behavior. The word treatment implies medical methods to cure or alleviate a disease. If the treatment results in a change of behavior toward the approved social standard, then psychiatrists generally would say the individual has recovered or is cured. The author's inferred point is recovery or cure are not appropriate terms either because the psychiatrist is not treating a disease. 7. The introduction of psychiatric considerations into the administration of the criminal law, for example, the insanity plea and verdict, diagnosis of mental incompetence to stand trial, and so forth, corrupt the law and victimize the subject on whose behalf they are ostensibly employed. The law tends to think of psychiatrists and their labeling method as a truly scientific method of medical diagnosis. Psychiatric diagnosis, as already stated, is a very unscientific method of labeling abnormal behavior. In reality, almost all criminal behavior is abnormal. It is questionable whether or not such diagnosis and related medical opinion helps anyone involved with the legal process. The current legal system in relation to psychiatric diagnosis victimizes all concerned. Since psychiatric diagnosis is very unscientific, it is highly likely that the defense will come up with one point of view that relates to insanity and the prosecution with another view, perhaps one that relates to the viciousness of the suspect. Although the insanity plea is an acceptable part of the law, the concept is essentially based on a superstition that an individual with a psychiatric disorder is compelled by strange forces to commit a criminal act. Another component of the superstition is the individual is not aware of the consequences of her actions. Perhaps an insane criminal is not totally aware of the possibilities of being apprehended, which is probably true with most criminals. Generally, people who have psychiatric disorders do not commit criminal acts. When they do, there might be a very irrational reason for the crime. This is certainly no reason for mercy. The fact that they are irrational means that their future behavior cannot be predicted, even if they appear to have been rehabilitated. Thus, such an individual should generally be incarcerated for a much longer period. I believe there is one situation where the insanity plea is justified. In some cases of temporary insanity, mercy might be justified, such as when the situation meets the following conditions. If the suspect was exposed to extremely provoking circumstances, which precipitated the criminal act. If the suspect's behavior is generally predictable and rational. If the suspect does not have a significant criminal history, and committed a crime he is accused of only once. If the suspect shows remorse for the crime. If the individual is highly unlikely to commit a similar criminal act ever again. The diagnosis of mental incompetence to stand trial is another difficulty with psychiatry and the law. Obviously, the defense and the prosecution can easily develop their own views and have them confirmed by their own psychiatrists. The author discusses on 239-page an interesting psychiatric disorder called Ganser syndrome, which is perhaps more accurately described as an impersonation of an individual who is insane. That is, it is not a true psychiatric disorder. The condition is found in prisoners who are about to stand trial. The prisoner essentially fakes mental incompetence. Some authorities actually believe the condition to be a true psychiatric disorder that is brought on by the stresses of being in prison for a crime and the stresses of facing a trial. Thus, it is relatively easy for the criminal defense lawyer to find a psychiatrist that would support the idea that his client is not mentally competent to stand trial. In general, mental incompetence can be easily faked and easily supported by a well-paid criminal defense lawyer and psychiatrist. I believe that the concept of incompetence to stand trial is an unfortunate and counterproductive part of the law. It would be better if the laws and customs governing the above were changed as follows. If there is indication that a suspect is incompetent or claims to be incompetent, the solution should be to provide him with special assistance in the trial. The special assistance should include, in addition to an attorney, a psychiatrist or psychologist, a social worker, and an advocate. The psychiatrist or psychologist and social worker would support the suspect's defense throughout the trial. The advocate could be a lawyer, which would be additional to the defense attorney. The job of the advocate would be to act as an additional representative of the suspect. The advocate would represent the views of the suspect, or if the suspect is totally incompetent, the views of his family. Generally, the advocate would try to maximize the effectiveness of the defense. He would see that the defense lawyer, the psychiatrist or psychologist and social worker are providing a maximum defense. Or in the case of a plea bargain, his role would be to see that his client is getting the best deal possible. Thus, with this method, even if the suspect cannot attend the trial, he should get a fair trial. 8. Personal conduct is always rule-following, strategic, and meaningful. Patterns of interpersonal and social relations may be regarded and analyzed as if they were games, the behavior of the players being governed by explicit or tacit game rules. There is essentially always some logic behind an individual's behavior. This might not always be apparent to others. The logic can be grossly distorted and not the best way of dealing with the world. However, the logic of even the most disturbed person follows a set of rules. These rules include the patterns of social interactions and related factors that the individual deals with in his world. That is, the above includes the strategies and general behavior patterns that the individual uses in communication and negotiation with the different individuals in her life. The above social interactions may be analyzed as if they were games. That is, the strategies of life can be thought of as a set of games. This includes the behavior of all the players involved and the rules that are used by the players. An individual with a psychiatric or psychological disorder plays an unusual or dysfunctional game. Her game might be offensive to others. For example, the game of a hysteric might manipulate and communicate by expressing their suffering with imaginary, or perhaps real, pains. If they do not want to do something, they will use the excuse of pain and sickness to avoid the activity. They will try to win pity, attention and assistance from others by verbally expressing their pain. This can include manipulative methods. The hysteric might try to punish others by trying to make them feel guilty. Such punishment might be inflicted on those who refuse to excuse the hysteric from her responsibilities or if they do not provide requested assistance. 9. In most types of voluntary psychotherapy, the therapist tries to elucidate the inexplicit game rules by which the client conducts himself, and to help the client scrutinize the goals and values of the life games he plays. Many types of psychotherapy can be described in terms of games, which are the strategies that one uses to deal with life. The psychiatrists try to learn about the games that the client plays, and who he plays the games with. The psychiatrist is especially interested in how the client plays the games, which include the rules that the patient follows. The goals and values associated with each game is also analyzed. The psychiatrist might play some of these games with the client, which could involve manipulation, negotiation, or communication methods. The psychiatrist's primary goal is to help the client become aware of her dysfunctional games. This is done with the hope of developing a critical perspective in the client, in relation to his games. In terms of games, the difference between an individual with a psychiatric disorder and a normal person is the type of games she plays and how she plays them. The goal of the psychiatrist according to this concept of games is to coax the patient into playing normal games in normal ways. The psychiatrist that is performing the above might not actually be thinking in terms of games. The doctor might be looking for dysfunctional behavior patterns, which is essentially a different version of the same basic concept. Many psychiatrists and patients do not think in terms of dysfunctional games or behavior patterns. The modern method is unfortunately to postulate that there is an unknown biochemical cause for a psychiatric disorder. Then the entire set of problems can be thought of as a disease and the doctor can prescribe medication to make the patient feel better. The medications that the psychiatrist provides often mask the problems at best. By conceptualizing the disorder as a disease, everybody involved can easily escape responsibility for the problems that relate to the psychiatric difficulties. The escape from responsibility includes parents who mistreat their child. In such cases, the child might be the patient. The patient escapes responsibility for her abnormal games. The patient also might, in severe cases, escape the normal responsibilities of life, such as military service, working for a living, etc. With many psychiatric disorders, the latter might be justified, whether or not the disorder is a disease or a set of dysfunctional games. But when the condition is conceptualized as a disease, the patient can easily escape the responsibility of rehabilitating his dysfunctional ways of thinking and acting, which ensures that the patient will never be faced with the normal responsibilities of life. 10. There is no medical, moral, or legal justification for involuntary psychiatric interventions. They are crimes against humanity. The author's point is that it is unjustified to place an individual in a mental hospital against his will. The idea of applying psychiatric treatment against the will of the patient is also quite inhuman. This cruelty reaches extreme levels with certain types of psychiatric treatment such as lobotomy and electroshock therapy. I believe that in the most extreme cases placing the patient in a psychiatric hospital against his will might be justified. Probably even the author would agree with this if he was informed by what I mean by the most extreme cases. Unfortunately, the most extreme cases are generally not hospitalized or treated. You can see these individuals with dirty clothes lying on the streets of New York City. Some of these individuals are also alcoholics and drug addicts. Their numbers, as seen on the streets, increased greatly several years ago after policies were developed to release long-term mental patients. It cost the city and state a large sum to keep such severely disturbed individuals hospitalized, and very little, if anything, to let them live on the streets. I do not believe the author has such individuals in mind when he makes the point that it is cruel to confine human beings against their will. In these very extreme cases, it is quite cruel not to confine these individuals in a psychiatric facility. They are so deranged that a fair number of these individuals freeze to death on the city streets each winter, in spite of the fact that they are eligible for shelters, subsidized housing, home care assistance, disability benefits, and many other services. They are simply too mentally deranged to apply for the services they need. The usual case of involuntary hospitalization is quite different than the extreme cases mentioned above. Often involuntary hospitalization and psychiatric treatment involves the family. One or more family members may inflict unwanted hospitalization and psychiatric treatment on another. The situation is most likely to involve parents inflicting treatment on their children. Perhaps, this might be justified if we could be sure that it was for the child's own long-term benefit. But when we consider the nature of psychiatric hospitalization and treatment, there is generally no way we can be sure of this. Other common situations include adult offspring committing their parents to a psychiatric facility, and husbands committing their wives to a mental hospital, and vice versa. Such family-related psychiatric commitments can be the result of either family conflict or difficulty in taking care of a child or an elderly parent. In actual situations of involuntary commitment of a family member, the individual that is committed might or might not be any more deranged than the rest of the family. The commitment can be the result of one or more members of the family engaging in long-term conflict with a less powerful member. Needless to say, it will most likely be the less powerful member who will be committed. Thus, generally involuntary psychiatric commitment or treatment is unfair, inhuman, and destructive. However, there are extreme cases where such involuntary commitment and treatment is justified for the benefit of the individual, his family, and society in general. Part 2: The Problem Mental Illness, Myth or Reality. The problem of mental illness, myth or reality, is summed up in this section, from a perspective that is somewhat different from the view presented in Part 1. The problem is evaluated with four components, which are the psychological, sociological, economic, and technological factors. The psychological components, mental illness, or more precisely psychiatric disorders generally speaking, are not illnesses. In reality, these disorders are psychological abnormalities. Psychiatric disorders can be divided into two general categories. 1. The individual may have dysfunctional ways of thinking, behaving, or of interpreting the world around him. 2. The individual's style of thinking, behaving, and interpreting the world can be unusual and functional, but others can respond in negative ways toward the individual because of the unusual factors involved. From statement 2, it is apparent that sociological dynamics are a primary component in understanding mental disorders, which is discussed in the next heading. The sociological components, whether or not a person is mentally ill, is often determined by sociological dynamics. One type of behavior pattern can be interpreted as quite sane and functional in one society and insane and dysfunctional in another. This same idea can even apply to different social groups within the same society. Insane behavior in one family might be considered quite sane and rational in another household. Appropriate behavior in a poor part of the city can be considered inappropriate and essentially insane in a richer part of town. Thus, mental illness is to some extent a matter of interpretation, based on the perceptions and evaluation of others. Even a schizophrenic who hallucinates can be considered quite sane in some primitive cultures. Such an individual might be considered a gifted person, perhaps a spiritual leader, who can see things that other people are not capable of seeing. Whether or not this is functional or dysfunctional is another matter. In such a culture, the schizophrenic would also consider himself as a gifted individual. Closely related to the above sociological concepts are the customs of the social group that the individual is involved with. If the individual violates the customary ways of doing things, she runs the risk of being labeled crazy or mentally ill. This can happen even if her violations of customary behavior are functional. Specifically, if a low-status individual violates such customs, without explanation she probably would be labeled as a mental case of some sort. However, If a powerful individual in the society violates customary ways and provides an explanation, she probably would not be labeled mentally ill. If a relatively large group of people violate customary ways in a collective manner, they will most likely not be considered mentally ill either. The concept of mental illness is generally applied to a single person on an individual basis. This should not be surprising because the assumption is that the unusual behavior is the result of an illness. The economic components. There are many economic components associated with the concept of mental illness. When an individual is diagnosed by a psychiatrist as having a mental illness, accompanied by a specific diagnosis, the patient becomes eligible for insurance compensation for the psychiatric services. Thus, the doctor is assured of getting paid, and the patient is relieved of the financial burden of seeing the psychiatrist on an ongoing basis. The doctor can be fairly sure that her patient will return week after week, because the psychiatric services would cost the patient little or nothing. The situation can be both highly functional and dysfunctional. It is functional when the individual has a significant adjustment problem or psychiatric disorder. These conditions might not be a true disease, but they can be just as disabling as a condition that has its origins in a malfunctioning physiology. Thus, treating the condition as a true illness from a financial perspective is certainly legitimate and functional in many cases. The dysfunctional situation is explained in the next paragraph. However, there are most likely some doctors and patients that take advantage of the situation. This can occur when the patient no longer needs treatment and the doctor continues treatment. The patient can play the sick role when she is no longer suffering from a disorder. This can happen on a conscious or unconscious level. It results in obtaining medical insurance benefits to maintain the medical services, and the patient can continue to obtain disability benefits. The situation can probably be most severe when the patient becomes accustomed or addicted to the medication provided by her psychiatrist. The psychiatric medication constitutes another major financial component involved with the mental health system. The concept of mental illness is facilitated by the advertising of the drug companies. Most of this advertising is aimed at doctors, especially psychiatrists. The drug companies try to carry out or support research that suggests that the psychiatric disorders are true biological illnesses, because it is in their financial interests to do so. This is not necessarily done in a dishonest way. If a researcher or the company that is financing his research has a financial reason to believe that a psychological disorder is a disease, the human psyche will assist them. That is, we see what we want to believe, and we tend to interpret results to support our own interests, which generally does not involve true dishonesty. Thus, the misconception of mental illness developed partly because there are financial dynamics involved. There are two basic ways that the myth of an illness can be perpetuated in the research laboratory and the doctor's office. The first way takes advantage of the fact that there are biological dynamics involved with all human behavior. For example, if a person is nervous because of environmental difficulties, there will be biochemical reactions in her body as a result. There are many ways of blocking these natural biochemical reactions with drugs. This will prevent the nervous reaction for a while. Obviously, the chemistry involved with nervous reactions and such drugs can be scientifically documented. This reality can easily be used falsely to suggest a biological cause, which is an illness. The second method of perpetuating the myth of an illness involves selecting unusual research subjects that would support the hypothetical ideas that are needed to support the disease theory of mental disorders. The following example is hypothetical, but it illustrates an important point. For example, if a researcher believes that schizophrenia is the result of a specific brain abnormality, he will search for schizophrenics that have that brain abnormality. No doubt, the researcher would find that most people diagnosed as having schizophrenia did not have the brain abnormality, but he can easily rationalize this by saying they were misdiagnosed. The label schizophrenic is unscientific and is routinely placed on individuals with many types of dysfunctional behavior patterns. Thus, nobody could successfully argue whether a patient was diagnosed correctly or not. Then the researcher can treat his unusual sample of schizophrenics, which have a brain abnormality, with experimental drugs. The next step would be to document the results and then try to market the drug to all the patients that have been diagnosed as schizophrenic. The irrational assumption and the advertising of the drug company would be that schizophrenia is the result of a brain abnormality and our drug controls the disease. Thus, the assumption would be that all those who have been labeled schizophrenia must have a brain abnormality and can benefit from the drug the company is trying to sell. The exact details of the above are a hypothetical example to illustrate the problem, but something very similar was actually done with schizophrenia, manic depressive disorders, clinical depression, and other psychiatric conditions. In general, the drug company and the doctor can ignore the fact that the condition is caused by environmental or psychological factors, and pretend that the condition is a disease. Sometimes this can actually be a sensible and functional solution to a psychiatric disorder, especially if the condition is also treated with psychotherapy. However, more often than not, it is probably dysfunctional. Most of the drugs lose their effectiveness as the body builds up resistance to the drugs. The individual that receives medicine for nervousness may end up with panic attacks as a result of taking medication for her nervous response to life circumstances. Then, to prevent the panic attacks, more drugs will be required. The drugs used for many mental disorders are essentially specialized tranquilizers that can act somewhat like a chemical straitjacket, rather than a true medical treatment. The effect of such drugs can be just as disabling as the disorder. The technological components. Technology has improved our lives in many ways. Technological developments have improved our living conditions, our food supply, our health, and just about everything else. However, in the area of mental health, technology may have made the problems even worse. The technological innovations in the mental health field were developed with mythological assumptions in mind. Some of the developments, in order of increasing destructiveness, are drug therapy, electroshock, insulin shock therapy, and the most destructive, lobotomy. Unfortunately, these methods are supported by many psychiatrists and are believed to be relatively safe. All of the above have been known to kill patients. However, there are some patients that strongly believe they recovered from a disease, which they never really had, as a result of such technological treatment. Before technologies can be developed to treat mental disorders, it is necessary to discard the mythology of mental illness. Then it is necessary to understand that mental disorders are generally the result of faulty learning and environmental conditions, which in certain cases have significant biological consequences. Starting with the above assumption would lead researchers to develop a very different set of technologies. However, the myth is part of our culture, and the mythology may continue to grow. Unfortunately, the current trends are toward more mythology supported by poorly designed experiments and more powerful drug therapies. The search for a cure for mental illness continues, but the search only signifies a society that is confused over the myth of mental illness.